New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in many of the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we'll be exploring mysticism and hypnosis. My guest is Dr. Etzel Cardenya, who holds the endowed Thorsen Chair at the Department of Psychology at Lund University in Sweden. Professor Cardenya does research in these interconnected areas, the neurophenomenology of hypnosis, meditation, and similar techniques, anomalous experiences, including psi phenomena, dissociative and other acute post-traumatic reactions, and the stream of consciousness. He is director of the Center for Research on Consciousness and Anomalous Psychology and has served as president of the Society of Psychological Hypnosis and the Society for Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis and the Parapsychological Association. He is the past editor of the Journal of Parapsychology, and he is editor of several anthologies, including Altering Consciousness, Multidisciplinary Perspectives, and Varieties of Anomalous Experience, and Parapsychology, a Handbook for the 21st Century. Etzel is based in Sweden, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Etzel. It's a pleasure to be with you again. It's been several years since I've been able to interview you, and I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Thank you for the invitation.
We'll be talking about mysticism and hypnosis. I know you've been a student of hypnosis ever since your graduate school days, and I think it's worth mentioning with regard to graduate school that you and I share something in common. We were both students of Charlie Tart at the University of California.
Yes, yes. So a greeting to him from both of us.
Yeah. Well, and Charlie, of course, was one of the major pioneers looking at altered states of consciousness, and you have definitely followed in his footsteps, much more so than I have. But let's talk about, to begin with, for example, your own doctoral dissertation research, which, as I recall, you were looking at what a deep state of hypnosis would be like, both qualitatively and quantitatively.
Correct. And I follow some of the procedures that Charlie had done. He had written a very interesting paper with one person who was highly hypnotizable. Highly hypnotizable means that a person is very responsive when you use a hypnotic procedure and you give suggestion, the person responds both behaviorally but also experientially. So if, for example, you tell the person, well, I'm going to show to you two cups in front and there's only one, but you tell them there are two cups in front of you, most of the people, you tell them, open your eyes, what do you see? Most people will say, well, I only see one. But the very highly hypnotizable people will say, I see two. And they can even describe them to you. And one of the surprises I remember from my dissertation is when I selected super hypnotizable people. They are very, very responsive. And when I did that test and a person starts describing, in this case, it was bottles that were not at all like the one I had. Not only was it two instead of one, but they were not at all like the one I had. And so I thought, well, this person has created, superimposed what she's thinking about over this physical object. And that struck me. And it was also, I think, one of the proofs that this person is not trying to pull my leg, because if she were trying to do that, she would have described two of the same kind of balls. No, she was coming up with something different. And not only is this an anecdote that may be supportive, but there is also psychophysiological studies showing that the brain responds in accord with the experience that the people are revealing to you. So, for example, if you find that this is done a study by Kosslyn and Spiegel and others, if you tell a person that they are going to see a very colorful paper and you just show them this, which is just white, highly hypnotizable people will start describing colors very specifically. Not only do they describe them, but when you look at the areas of the brain that process color, they become active. So what they say they are experiencing, they are living, and it is affecting their physiology, which should not surprise us, but because, unless we think they are lying to us. But it just shows these are very genuine responses. So to come to your original question, what is neutral hypnosis or minimal suggestion hypnosis, or trying to go in deep? What I and other people try to do, try to investigate, is what happens when you give as little suggestions as possible. And the reason for this is that for highly hypnotizable people, whatever you tell them to experience, they will experience. So if you tell them, well, right now, the time is going to go very, very slowly, as if this was a very boring event. And then later on, you ask them, how did the time run? They will say it was very slowly. If you tell other people, or that same individual at another time, now under hypnosis, the time goes very rapidly, that's what they will experience. So what one tries to do is, well, what is hypnosis trying to give as little or as few suggestions as possible? And just as an anticipation in this study, what I did with these very highly hypnotizable people is give them a super sophisticated induction. And induction is how you tell a person to go into hypnosis. I gave them a super sophisticated induction, which was counting from 1 to 30. That was it. You know, I used my hypnotic voice. It was like 1, 2, 3, but it was 1, 2, and a pause. So that this is something that you should focus on. This is serious. But that was it. Counting 1 to 30, telling them that they will go more deep into hypnosis. And then every 5 minutes, I would ask them, what are you experiencing? So in that way, I was trying to say, well, what do these highly hypnotizable people experience when they are in this unusual context? And I'm not giving them any other suggestions.
With regard to hypnosis, you do have a scale. Some people are highly hypnotizable and other people can barely be hypnotized at all, and probably not, as a matter of fact. Some people resist it completely. So, whereas with other forms of altered states of consciousness, like psychedelics, for example, you don't have that. If somebody takes a psychedelic substance, typically it will impact all people.
Yes, although I have come to realize recently that there are also individual differences, even for people who are taking psychedelics. And I do not mean somebody has a good trip versus a bad trip, but one is more affected than other people. And this is an area that has not been researched enough. But I suspect that, yes, psychedelics is like plugging yourself, whatever is in your mind, plugging it into, let's say, a big amplifier. So whatever it is just goes 100-fold what it was there. And so you tend to experience something, even if, let's say, you would say, well, I don't have imagery. I don't tend to experience more. I'm not very experiential. I'm only thinking in words. Even those people, I think, will be more likely to experience something than if they were in hypnosis. Mm. But what is striking, let me say, is that even though I would say psychedelics, yes, generally speaking, are much stronger, more intense, and also less controllable than hypnosis, some of the responses are similar. I would say that what I found in my doctoral dissertation, alongside with what other people found using similar types of approaches of neutral hypnosis, is that the very highly hypnotizable people would end up seeing lights, having very strong imagery, being in somewhat like a lucid dream, remaining still awake, but being in an imagery that seemed to be so real that they felt that was more real than the perceptual world, that they might feel that they were communing with the light or with everything in the world. Sort of a lot of the things that happen in psychedelic, in some psychedelic experiences were also there. So what it made me think is that psychedelics work because they are mimicking already the neurotransmitters we have, particularly serotonin. They are mimicking that, being agonists for those receptors, but they are mimicking something that is already there. And I think that the highly hypnotizable people are probably closer to that, are being in that space or in that possibility of having strong experiences, even without using any drugs. And again, I would say with advantages and disadvantages. But one of the advantages is that when I was doing my study with the highly hypnotizable people, some of them had outright mystical experience where they felt connected with everything. They felt they were back home. And I'm quoting what they said, again, without any suggestions, that time and space no longer meant anything. And we were in a setup where I said, well, we'll go for this session for as long as you want. There are no time limits. And when people started telling me that, you know, the first couple of times, I started getting worried because I thought, well, what if, since they say they are in the best place in the world, maybe they'll want to stay there. Mm-hmm. So when will I tell them, hey, now I need to go home? There. But something that was remarkable for me, at least, and I would say was a finding, is that somewhere around after an hour, let's say between 45 to 75 minutes or so, even if they had been in that perfect spot, they would suddenly just spontaneously start saying, okay, well, I'm starting now to think about everyday things. I'm starting to be back in my body. So I think that we have a biological rhythm where those people can get into those experiences, but they're not going to stay there forever or for hours. Whereas a psychedelic forces you, you know, maybe a psychedelic trip with LSD, more than 10 hours or about 10 hours of staying there. And unless you take something, you are in that place. Whereas in hypnosis, some similar events, perhaps not as intense or not as intense, but not as long and much more controllable.
Well, I think there are many features of mystical organizations, esoteric organizations, and the culture that surrounds them that are in some ways comparable to hypnosis. I mean, the obvious one would be meditation, that some people seem to be able naturally to go very deeply into a meditative state, and other people can't do it at all.
Yes, and even though I haven't done specifically a study on people who go easily into meditation and people who are highly hypnotizable, there are other people who have done those studies. The literature is a bit mixed. What I have done, or what we have done, is a study where we looked at a number of other constructs that have to do with whether you can become absorbed on something, let's say on a movie or an art event or on nature, or on your child, or you can get fully into it. And that capacity, which is called absorption, related to being highly hypnotizable. Then we also used another measure to see how much do you feel that you are part of something larger than you. It's called self-transcendence. And that capacity was also associated to being highly hypnotizable. And the third one was a construct called boundaries, mental boundaries. And that is, how much do you feel that you are, let's say, an isolated creature bordered by your body, and that you are really one individual encapsulated that may interact with others, but you are your own person, which would be called a thick-boundaried person that has thick boundaries, as compared with people who are more thin-boundaried, which means people who, let's say, may start talking with someone they get along with, and at one point they sort of lose track of time. They're not quite sure of, did you say that? Did I say that? And they can flow into the other person. They can become more easily a longer, let's say, unboundaried or less boundaried self. And that kind of construct also related to being highly hypnotizable. So I would say more generally that one can think of hypnotizability is one particularly somewhat semi-weird, because it's strange when you think about it. Somebody comes and tells you, I'm going to hypnotize you, I'm going to tell you this. It's our own particular cultural way. Cultures have really other rituals that do something similar, but we do it very verbally. And in which we are telling person, can you sort of change the way that you are relating now? Can you become less boundaried? Can you stop the distinction that you make between this is real and this is fake, and make it so that if I imagine it, if I think it enough, then it becomes real, at least partly real? Can you do that? And that is what hypnosis is, in a sense, is inviting a person to say, can you yourself control to an extent, being able to modify how you experience yourself and the world? And that is a fantastic capacity. You know, as we are talking about, I'm in a sense developing more an idea that has been roaming around, but that I think expands the notion of what hypnosis is as far as a state, and leaving it aside for a moment, the issue about suggestion, which can be very negative, and talk more about the extraordinary capabilities that can happen when you are in your experience without thinking about what am I expecting or what is my brain, if you're using the brain as a predicting kind of mechanism, what do I predict will happen? Instead of that, sort of remaining more open to things that occur, or to things that you say to yourself that may go counter to what you ordinarily would expect. So it expands the notion of what we can do, who we can be, and what we can experience.
I used hypnosis as a high school student to take tests, and I found it was enormously successful, self-hypnosis, in preparation for the SAT test. And it was very quantitative in the sense that the year before, as a junior in high school, when I grew up, you took what was called the PSAT, the preliminary scholastic aptitude test, which is supposed to predict how well you will do when you take the final big scholastic aptitude test. But I used hypnosis for the SAT as a senior in high school, and my scores jumped way above what would have been predicted by the PSAT, the preliminary test. So I've been a strong believer in the use of self-hypnosis ever since then.
Yes, and I could tell you I have used it as well. I do not say, oh, this is a cure for everything, a cure-all. This cannot make me levitate or anything like that. But when I had a medical intervention a number of years ago, said, well, I'm going to try to make the pain go away as rapidly as possible and to be able to move as rapidly as possible. And I was moving before anybody else in the ward. And I was able to recover very, very rapidly. Now, this is not a study, but there have been other studies that have shown that, yes, it helps. So, you know, another way, recently people have been talking about the Rebus model for psychedelics, whether psychedelics can affect your automaticity so that your brain or your mind is not just predicting what is going to happen and not allowing you to see things. But in hypnosis, we have known that for a while. And if you use hypnosis positively, I think what you're trying to do is to stop the tape that tells you, oh, I cannot learn this. Maybe in your case, I'm not able to memorize as well. By doing hypnosis, you put that in abeyance. You hit a pause to all of those judgments and expectations, and then something else can take their place and allow you to do better, to feel better, to experience more.
Would it be fair to say that if you're doing this consistently, changing your state, eventually it becomes more than just a change of state, it becomes a trait?
I think it can happen. I know, because I use hypnosis, but for specific cases. I do not use it every day or every night, partly because I have a very rich life. Now, I would say, thank God I'm hypnotized by my wife and my boy, in the sense that they open my experiences of everything rich in life pretty much every day when I'm interacting with them. So I don't think I need anything more. And I could say that I have expanded. But let's say for somebody who isn't in that particular characteristic, I think were you to do that consistently, it would become easier, and then you might be able to be more in that space. I have a friend from Argentina, and she has very unusual experiences, and I think it is because she's very interested in what goes through her mind, to try to understand what that is, to try to understand how that relates to reality. And she does that very consistently. And just yesterday, she told me that this has become more and more frequent, that this kind of being in the world, where she can have perhaps a more present, rich, sensual, as far as the senses perspective, that has become more and more part of who she is. So I would say, yes, it can happen from meditation, but it can also happen from other experiences, as long as you are trying to remain open and creating more rather than just being conditioned and doing things automatically.
Now, with regard to hypnosis, it's probably worth pointing out, not all of our viewers and listeners will realize that hypnosis started in the 18th century, and at that time, it was a completely different context. It was called mesmerism, and it didn't have to, the word hypnosis wasn't even used at all, and the traits that people experienced or states that people experienced were very different than simply going into deep relaxation.
Yes, and let me divide a bit my answer on two things. First, the notion that hypnosis started with mesmerism, with Franz Anton Mesmer's practices and so on, it's a convenient kind of summary. But of course, it's quite a bit fake, insofar as there have been practices all along. There is an classical Egyptian papyrus that is talking about how to become more attentive to your breathing and to be able to say things that will be more likely to happen. There is a Spaniard author, Pedro Laín Intralgo, who wrote a very interesting book, just tracing in classical antiquity how all of these practices of trying to affect a person's health and a person's well-being have been there all along. They became in modern times, a bit more systematized as a result of what Mesmer was doing. And what Mesmer was doing was really very different than what we do today. So now let me take it from there. Mesmer was a Viennese physician who was very charismatic. He had an idea, and his idea was following the scientific notions of the time, that there was magnetism all throughout, and that people became sick because of an imbalance of their own magnetism, the animal magnetism within. So at first he would use magnets, and he was not the only one, but he would use magnets to try to sort of arrange, move the energy that was not in equilibrium. And if you're thinking, well, does this look like chai or qi, you know, those Eastern kind of concepts about energy? Well, of course it does. I don't think he took the idea from the East or from Asian countries, but nonetheless, there is a great commonality. And so at first he was using magnets, and then he started using his hands. And he was not the most, shall we say, humble individual. So he thought he had more than everybody else. In this case, it was more animal magnetism and more ability to do things. So he started doing healing procedures, and sometimes he was wildly successful. Now, one thing that one needs to remember is that at that time, the alternatives to animal magnetism or to mesmerism were to be bled with leeches or to be burned with sort of candles that you put on top. You know, both of them, terrible procedures that would likely make you worse. Oh, and also to purge you, you know, to make you vomit and so on. You know, so the cures were actually things that would make you more sick. Instead, you had this person who was giving his attention, this very charismatic individual who was giving his all attention. And just think nowadays, what is the effect of charismatic people, artists, politicians, and so on who come, and then people faint or feel, oh, I am, you know, I'm in love with you. This is extraordinary. All of that has been all around that time. But Mesmer was trying to use this to help people, and he did it by trying to have a very more rock-like concert type of environment where people, noble people, noble in the sense they were of the nobility, not necessarily good people, but were members of the French nobility, would go around, and he would come with purple robes. There was music playing, and then someone might start fainting and making sounds and crying. And then this was supposed to be the crisis that he was going to use to rearrange and rebalance the energy of the individual. Now, if you think, does that sound like what happens nowadays in a hypnotic session? Not at all. What happened, though, is that one of his disciples, the Marquis de Puységur, started doing something that was more tranquil. And then one of his peasants, Victor Ras, suddenly fell into what looked like a sleep. And in his sleep, he seemed to be able to know more, to have greater wisdom. And then from that kind of practice in which hypnosis, or let's say what later would be called hypnosis or mesmerism, was seen as being more sedate, more individual, less being in a group with people fainting, falling, crying, it became something very different, something much more like relaxation and something like sleep. Now, we know that what goes in hypnosis is not sleep. If you look at the brain physiology and so on, they are different. It's not the same. It is not as if you go to sleep. And in fact, you can do a hypnotic procedure where you ask the person to become more active and alert, not more relaxed. But from those procedures of the Marquis de Puységur, we ended up having something much closer to what we have nowadays, where you have a person, the hypnotist, the therapist, who is going to help you enter potentially a state or a condition in which you will be more focused and you will hear suggestions that may be able to help you. In the case of self-hypnosis, as you already pointed out, you are both the hypnotist and the hypnotized person. So you take both roles.
Well, in the story of the Marquis de Puységur, it appears as if that's a crucial moment in the history of mesmerism and hypnosis, because, as I understand it, the peasant who was his subject was producing paranormal phenomena, and hypnosis or mesmerism or whatever it was called in that moment was not so different from the later work of the spiritualists.
Absolutely. I would say that there were two strands of what happened after the Marquis de Puységur. One strand was to have these procedures become therapeutic in some way. The other strand was the more extraordinary things happen, things that look like perhaps psychological, telepathic abilities, and other abilities that you have also happen. And that strand, I think, ended up being transformed into what spiritualism came or became. Because now some spiritualists would use directly hypnotic procedures, or even without knowing what they were, they would use some of the same type of techniques to do the same. So I think secularly you ended up having, well, let's use hypnosis for medical procedures and later on for psychological ailments. And then the other strand became more like spiritually, became associated with the idea that you may be able to communicate with that people. That was not necessarily at the beginning of mesmerism. You know, at the beginning of mesmerism was the idea of perhaps you can have telepathic abilities. You are able to recognize events that occur. But it is not that long of a step to say, well, if you are able to communicate at a distance and maybe know what is going to happen, well, maybe you can have those abilities to be able to contact dead people, because there would be a great need for that. So if you just indulge me one last thing, because as you know, I also write on parapsychology, I do research on parapsychology, I think there is definitely good supportive evidence for this phenomena. But I would say a lot of what was written at that time was fine for the criteria of that time, or for the standards. So some people, including Puységur, including Mesmer, would say, well, I had a patient or a person that was mesmerized, and he or she was reading my mind. He or she knew what I was going to suggest to, let's be stereotypical, to her. Let's say a male hypnotist, a female mesmerist. She knew before I said it. And that impressed him, and I do not doubt that that happened. Now, how to explain it? One possibility is, yeah, it might have been telepathy, but the other thing that they were not considering, and that we now know when we do parapsychology research, at least since the beginning of the 20th century, is that also people can communicate non-verbally, even without realizing it. And even as there has been research showing that there is sort of you're affecting your throat even before you say it, just by your thoughts. And conceivably, at least conceivably, theoretically, someone might be able, someone very sensitive might be able to hear something. So that to really have a good test for telepathy, you cannot have the person who is going to give a message in the same place as the person who's supposed to receive it, because it could come from, and you know, mentalists do that all the time. They are able to guess things that you would say, how can they do that? They have to be psychic. No, they do not necessarily have to be psychic, but they are able to read very sensitively different ways of positioning, perhaps the beginning of a word that has been sort of thought about, said very, very, you know, very lowly. Nobody else hears it, but they are able to perceive it. So a lot of that, I'm sure, happened at the mesmerist time, but it might or might not have been psychic phenomena. They reported it as they should have, but we do not know at this point how much that what would pass muster.
Well, I think it's fair to say, though, that subsequently parapsychologists have done a wide range of studies using hypnosis and other relaxation procedures, including meditation and Jacobsonian relaxation. And pretty consistently, people score better on ESP tests when they're more relaxed.
More generally, when people are in an altered state, whether it is coming from meditation or use of hypnotic techniques or Ganzfeld, which is just placing an individual in homogeneous stimulation where they only see redness and they are only hearing a pink sound, like shh sound. When they are in those procedures, they do better, significantly better. And you can look at, and if you want, I can send you later a slide if you want to add it. You can look at the amount of effect. When people are just waking state, they do not feel that they are altered at all. And when they feel that they have followed procedures to affect their consciousness, they do significantly better. Chuck Honerton, Charles Honerton, did work like this decades ago, and we have continued finding that relation. Which is, I think, to come back to Charlie Tart, why you could see why he was interested probably in both areas, because one leads easily to the other.
In other words, there seems to be a relationship between paranormal experiences or paranormal abilities and what we might call altered states or transcendental states of consciousness.
There is a bit of a wrinkle on that. In the first study, we found that people who were highly hypnotizable and who felt that they were in an altered state in the procedure, in the Ganzfeld procedure, then did better in another session where they were tested for ESP, or for PSI, or anomalous cognition. And then we ended up doing a second study with a larger sample and only with people who were highly hypnotizable. And in this, we found more clearly that when people felt that in Ganzfeld they were more in an altered state, that their consciousness had been altered more, those people tended to be more accurate at choosing the correct film clip from three other film clips that were just decoys. So another way of stating it is what we have found here, and we have now a project with about six other laboratories throughout the world where we are testing that. But what we found in two studies is that, yes, there seems to be the case, and that certainly goes along with what a number of other labs throughout the world have found, that there is a relation, which also makes it more likely that probably at the time of Mesmer and so on, psi phenomena might have happened. Not evaluated as we might do nowadays, not being as careful because they do not have that accumulated knowledge, but they might have had bona fide events occurring because people were in a different state. And just think for a moment. Right now, hypnosis, you see it on TV, you can talk about it, there are apps and so on. But at that time, when a person said there is an individual who has these extraordinary powers who's going to affect you, probably some people were very, very much affected.
Well, let's shift gears for a moment and talk about mysticism. My understanding is that the academic study of mysticism is pretty much divided into two camps. In one camp, I'll call them the postmodernists, they feel that we cannot compare a mystical experience from one culture to another. We can't even know when a person reports a mystical experience what they're actually experiencing because their language is culture bound and we can't understand all of the cultural concomitants of their language. So we'll never understand what the mystical experience is really about. And another group of people, the perennialists, would say, no, there are commonalities that appear across cultures in people who have a mystical experience. So it's a real thing that we can study.
Yes. And I would say that both from a number of different strands, I would think that the answer uses both perspectives, but I would say perhaps with a stronger leaning towards the perennialists, in the sense that There are many religious experiences. Not all religious experiences are mystical at all. But let's say the notion of I suddenly felt that I was part of a much larger whole, whether the whole world or I was one with the divinity, God or goddess, or whole of nature or the Godhead, that when, or the ground of the universe, if you do not want to use any kind of religious, that experience and a number of related phenomena to it, such as a sense of, and I have a sense that the world is important, is valuable, it's not just meaningless, I feel wonderful at having this experience, that all of those kind of reports have been fairly common throughout cultures. Now, again, not everything that has been called mystical is like this, and there are some that should not. And then sometimes people have an experience like this, and then they accommodate it to a particular ideology, a particular religious ideology. And then they will say, well, I think that I became one with Brahma, or I became one with Christ. And you know, that, of course, is showing that a particular cultural patina is affecting or is coloring how a person is interpreting what they had. So I think that is real, but it is somewhat very similar to what happened with near-death experiences, where if you look very minutely, you will find that there are differences and that there are cultural differences, that people in, let's say, Hindu countries are more likely to talk about Hindu divinities. People from Christian cultures are more likely to refer to Christ or the God or the Godfather or something like that. But when you look at, if you will, a broader scope, you will find that there are many commonalities nonetheless. You know, leaving aside that cultural patina, you will find that the experience has this and this and this and this characteristic, and you listen to it and it's very similar. And in my case, I think the dissertation that I did, and then a later study with a larger group, what I would say I found was more of a support for the perennialist position, insofar as we were doing a study that was not religious. It was not announced as religious experience. Both studies talked about, were interested about what hypnosis is, what the hypnotic experience is like. And I don't think hypnosis by itself is thought of as being religious or Christian or anything like that. So I don't think it was that. I think we were careful to not have any kind of spiritual or religious side to it. And nonetheless, people spontaneously, without suggestions, ended up coming with the notions of, this is my home. I came back to where I really feel that I am the best. This, I feel joy. I feel serenity. I feel closer to everyone, to everything. I am calm. Everything is perfect as it should be. There is no time here. People spontaneously were reporting that as outside of the context. So I would say, even though you may find that people may have those experiences outside of a hypnotic experiment, of course, and may later on go on to interpret it according to a spiritual tradition or a religious tradition, nonetheless, these people had that. And it was very surprising to a number of them. I remember particularly in the first study where I got to interact a lot with those people, that they would come and ask me and tell them, am I crazy? Because when they had these experiences, they said, what is going on with me? You said nothing and I'm having these experiences. And before we finished the experiment, what I would tell them is, no, you know, you're not going crazy. Some people have had similar experiences. I'll tell you more once we are done. So I would not tell them, whoa, you had a mystical experience. Can I have one myself? Instead of recording you. I did not do any of that, and they still have it. And when you look at, well, same kind of reports come from meditation, neutral hypnosis, spontaneous hypnotic experiences, psychedelics, just naturally a person experiences something when their child is born, or they are out in nature, or as they are dying sometimes. You see, well, there are so many different contexts, so many different cultures. This does not seem to be something trivial or arbitrary. There is something common to it. Now, where you want to take it ontologically is, are these experiences telling us something about reality, or are they just fantasies? You know, nice fairy tales that somehow our unconscious tell us. And if you're going to be very psychoanalytic, well, maybe you want to go back to being a child within your mom, you know, inside, or something like that. You could interpret it that way, of course, except that I don't think probably fetuses have all of this range of experiences, and that furthermore, when you look at the evidence from parapsychological phenomena, the notion that we are not only bound by the senses and the reason is stronger, is more supported, that there is something more to us. So you have supportive evidence from a number of different strands that I think would allow you to at least entertain this. Can you be certain? Can you be absolutely certain? I'm not absolutely certain of almost anything in life, but I think you can make a good case. Well, this is reasonable. There is some empirical evidence for it. People who have thought and written about this come to the same conclusion. So one can entertain it very lucidly and very rationally and very emotionally as well, because these experiences have a deep underground of positive emotion, and consider this is part of what being human is. Do we know? Do we have the final solution, the final answer? Well, no, at least while we are alive, I don't think we have, or maybe we do, but so sort of just for moments. And then we lose it in the everyday ding of things.
As I recall, it was Sigmund Freud who suggested that the mystical experience is really nothing more than a regression to an infantile state, and he thought very little of it. And I suppose it's true in general. The word mystical has a negative connotation in many, many communities, particularly in academia.
It's very, very sad, because I think you have also extraordinary thinkers who have entertained both. Let me just mention, of course, there's a long list, but let me just mention quickly two of them. Bertrand Russell, I think one of the towering philosophers of the 20th century, he has an essay, a small essay I read as a graduate student, something like mysticism and...
And logic.
Mysticism and logic. Good memory. Yeah, mysticism and logic. Yeah. And he said, well, they both are giving us supplementary different things. It is not as if one can overrule the other. The best way is to have both. So that is striking philosopher. I think then if you take a theoretical quantum physicist like Despagnol, when he's talking about what are the implications of quantum mechanics and the notion that there is no such thing as space when we look at it, that in some way everything is interconnected. I have quoted one of his books, which was Physics and Philosophy, where he said the mystics have something, the mystics and the artists, that intuition they, or some artists, that intuition they have says something about what is the underlying structure of the surface of reality. So you have someone like him. Oppenheimer was also very open. You know, unfortunately, he got okay, was the atomic bomb, but he was just one out of many. But he was another genius who obviously was extremely rational and logical, and nonetheless also had the notion of you can have, and you should try to have, both aspects. And more generally, let's say in my... You interviewed me some years ago about my book, Varieties of Anomalous Experience, edited book. We have a great chapter by David Wolf there, where he reviews the evidence from research. What do we know about people who are more mystics? Are they less logical? Are they more pathological? Do they have more psychological problems? And it's exactly the other way around. They tend to be more successful, they are perfectly fine, and they tend to be psychologically well, better than average. Does that mean that everyone who has sort of a sense of merging and that has some idea like that is psychologically fine? Of course not. The same way that not every person who is left-handed is fine, but most people who are left-handed, the same way as most people who are mystical, are fine. And in the case of mystics, more successful, they seem to be happier. They seem to be more psychologically balanced. So if nothing else, unless you think that you already have the answer about reality and who you are, and if you think that, well, good luck to you. I don't think you have learned much, because we have had many people who thought that, and then they showed that they did not know what they were talking about. But unless you have that, I think you could think, well, if I entertain this possibility, it looks like I may be able to live a more balanced and happy life. If nothing else, you might entertain it. And that it is not necessarily an illogical, pathological, easy, misty, loosey, unphilosophical perspective. It isn't.
I was very influenced by the work of Abraham Maslow, a psychologist back in the 1940s. He looked at the most successful people of his era, people like Albert Einstein and Eleanor Roosevelt, and he interviewed them, and he learned that almost every single one of these people had what he came to call a peak experience. It didn't have any religious connotations to it. But then he said, actually, if you look at the qualitative experience, it's a peak experience is indistinguishable from a mystical experience. And that these experiences were central to how successful they had become.
Yes, I did not mention it, but I would say, yes, you're absolutely right. He pointed that out. Later empirical research using questionnaires and so on have borne what he had mentioned. And overall, it is the case. And I think if you want to live a happier life, you're more likely to do it if you at least feel this notion of interconnectedness, because it is extraordinary what we have to be alive. Now, for those of us who are fortunate, who are not in the midst of wars that are hurting us, injuring us, killing close to us, killing our children, if we are not in those experiences, what a gift, you know. And sometimes most of the times we forget that. And I would say sometimes peak experiences, whether they're coming from hypnosis, meditation, psychedelics, your child, your spouse, whatever, you know, sometimes those are moments that remind you, look at this. We're able to see all of this. We're able to hear this. And furthermore, yes, the bird is not particularly singing to me in some sense, but in another sense, the bird is doing that because the bird is singing and I'm here and I'm hearing it and I am enjoying it. And isn't it extraordinary? And have we done anything to deserve this? I personally think I don't deserve all of this, but thank God I'm not giving it back. I'm not sending it back. Even if Amazon has a good refund policy.
It's beautifully put. And now I'd like to go back to one of your experiments where you used what you call neutral hypnosis. We discussed that a little earlier, where the goal of neutral hypnosis is to avoid as much as possible any particular hypnotic suggestion other than get in touch with yourself.
Yes. Yes. And we have done two studies with that. And using that to sort of distinguish between the artifact, that is the specific suggestions, and the essence, which would be, what is it like to be in this circumstance? What is it like to go inside of yourself and stay there and not be distracted and not be worried and not be thinking about what to do tomorrow and so on? What happens then? And that is when my participants started having mystical experiences. without suggestions. And some of them were beautiful. And they did not have to be close to dying, as in near-death experience. They did not have to take drugs. And, you know, this is not to say everybody can do it easily. But not everybody can do everything easily. There are some people who can do that more easily. And we can learn from those who are better than us at doing that.
And I assume that these were highly hypnotizable people who went into the mystical state under neutral hypnosis.
Let me tell you something. First, there was the first study for the dissertation. There was only very highly hypnotizable people. You know, I had screened, I don't remember who it was, 200 or something, to get a few people. So these were, and I tested them, and they were very, very highly hypnotizable in that they not only did behavioral suggestions, follow behavioral suggestions, but they also experienced a lot what I was asking them to experience. So if I told them, okay, I want you to imagine that you have your hand in a pail of cold water. It's ice there, you're not going to feel anything. And so I would give them suggestions when I was testing them originally before the experiment. And then I would give them electric shocks, you know, starting from mild. So I'm not a sadist, but I would start from very mild and then I would go up. You know, do you feel that? Yes, no, yes. Does it bother you? No. And then I would go up and then I would go up. There were three gradients, none of which would cause tissue injury or anything like that. But believe me that the second one was definitely noticeable and not pleasant, and the third one was unpleasant if you were not following the suggestion. And all of these people would say, yeah, I'm not feeling anything. So behaviorally, they did not show anything. They showed no grimaces. So these were very highly hypnotizable people, and they had these suggestions. Now, after that initial experiment, the question remained, well, maybe it's something in my procedure, and maybe everyone would end up reporting this kind of transcendent experiences. So in a later experiment, which I did here in Sweden, I had both high hypnotizables, low hypnotizables, people who don't respond to suggestions, and people in the middle, those who are in between. And then I did the same procedure where I didn't give them any suggestion other than counting from 1 to 30 and telling them, go as deep into hypnosis as you can. And then every 5 minutes, I would ask them during the session, what are you experiencing? So what happened with these three different groups? First, the low hypnotizables. When I asked them and I analyzed their experiment, and I had somebody who was mass analyzing, what are you experiencing? The electrodes hurt because they had an electrode cap, or I'm thinking about homework, or I'm getting hungry. So they were in their everyday type of experience. That was it, which is not bad or good. That's where they were. Mm-hmm. The people in the middle, they would start sort of seeing some images. Not so much that they would be like in a lucid dream where they were in that image and they thought that imagery was more real than real, but they were sort of not thinking about everyday things, but seeing a bit of imagery. And it was in the highly hypnotizable and this completely different group where, again, I had people saying, oh, this is wonderful. I feel connected with the sea. I'm being part of the sea. You know, this aspects of joyfulness, of serenity, it happened to those high hypnotizable, not to the other two groups.
So I suppose it'd be fair to say it's still an open question as to whether this transcendental state is a natural baseline for all people.
Well, some traditions claim that.
Yeah.
The way I see it is that I see different states of consciousness as different options we have to interact with the world. Rather than thinking there is one, I use the metaphor of the radio or TV station if you want. I just wrote recently something about that. And I take it one step further. So instead of saying, well, consciousness may be something that is not only created by the brain, it's something more, but you need the brain to synthesize. But I'm saying, but it also, you have different channels in consciousness, or you have different possibilities. And the way I see them is that there is not like one or one underlying. I think there are different channels that are good for different things. And sometimes there's a channel, let's say, that you can make clear. So, for example, in everyday life, I would say that probably most of us have a somewhat, we're not quite synchronized to the correct filter. So we are somewhere between. So we sort of see things. We sort of perceive things. You know, we are not seeing a car coming at us or anything like that. But we're still very much in our resentment, in our everyday life. We are not seeing the beauty around us. So I think that you can synchronize that better if, for example, you become more mindful and you become more centered into what am I seeing, what am I experiencing, and then you are closer to that. But there are other channels. I think that the way of thinking of other states is these are other channels. Now, sometimes people talk about the highest state of consciousness, and I'm not sure that there is one. I think that there are different ones for different things. And for example, if you want to create something new, probably it's good that you get into all kinds of weird, chaotic type of states where things are crossing together and you are making all kinds of unusual links and getting absurd things and maybe even sometimes getting anxious about it. And maybe that is good for that specific task rather than being just completely serene, Buddha-like person who is interacting and perceiving everything there is. So at this point, at least, that's how I see it. So I know that some traditions would say this is the baseline. And I would say, well, what I think is that most of us are, when we are awake, and only when we are awake, of course, not when we are asleep, and when we're asleep, we're in different states. But when we're awake, we tend to be in more or less one state, but it's not very well synchronized. So we can tune it better by mindfulness or something like that and be more present in that state. But then you, at other times, you may want to go crazy and you may want to be boundaryless. And then your child cries and then you should become very boundaried and think, okay, what makes sense? Rather than, well, you know, in the ultimate cosmic view of things, we are all dust, so why does it matter?
What you're saying suggests that consciousness itself is the largest multi-purpose tool available to humans.
Well, I don't like the word tool because it sounds very mechanic, but yes, yeah. you get the idea. It's the most, that we have this tremendous amount of gifts. If you think of the world, the cosmos, as being this infinite amount of possibilities and developments. Well, if we share of this, if we are dust of stars, as you know, cosmologists have said, well, probably we also share in this vastness, which we tend to underuse. Given our finite lives, our own particular selfish endeavors, our own particular neurotic developments, and those of our parents, you know, given all of that, we tend to have become very limited. But we have, I think, much greater capabilities with some risks. You know, some states are bad. You know, people who are psychotic are not in a good channel. I would say they're in a channel where there is no kind of music coming, not classical or rock or anything. It's just cacophonous, unpleasant, disharmonious noise. But there are many others that we can be in. And if you think, might there be something that is beyond all of that? Yes. Although, you know, it's beyond me, beyond my capabilities. Other than say, I think that is a possibility.
Well, Edsel Cardenia, what an excursion this has been, a deep exploration into many facets of both hypnosis and transcendental or mystical states. It's been a real pleasure to connect with you. Thank you so much for being with me and with the New Thinking Aloud audience.
Thank you so much, Jeff. And I appreciate this because actually by interacting and talking about this, I think it allowed me to travel, go express things in a way that helped me as well.
You're a wonderful presenter, and I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. And for our viewers and listeners, thank you as well for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.